Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 584, titled Rewriting History. This has been recorded on February 4th of 2007, Super Bowl Sunday. Truly a time of much celebrated and broadly participant illusion here in the United States. And what we've been talking about is the attempt at either successfully perpetuating political and cultural illusions, and or attempting to recreate new political traditions by disseminating lies about historical events that have come to be accepted as true. A nice chunk of side one focused on the Holocaust denial conference that took place recently in Iran, and specifically we were talking about some of the political connections of Ahmed Huber and the Bank al-Taqwa milieu, which are very close to Ahmadinejad. The thrust of the primary focal point of discussion on side one is what the Holocaust Denial Conference actually constitutes. And what you are seeing is a petroleum-producing regime that is going for nuclear weapons that is in turn politically allied with Ku Klux Klansmen, European and American neo-Nazis, and is headed up by a guy who not only engages in Holocaust denial, but who is a subscriber to the 12th Imam apocalyptic scenario in Islam. And I think the combination of Nazis and nukes and apocalyptic religious philosophy, all of that fueled with petroleum wealth, is a really, really unhealthy combination. And if you want to know what it was like in the run-up to World War II and why nobody could see fit to confront Hitler and Mussolini, well, there were very powerful economic forces allied with Hitler and Mussolini and their doctrinaire anti-communism, and as well as the fact that they were business partners with some powerful people in the West. That is to say, the regimes of Mussolini and Hitler were business partners with powerful people in the West. That helped to dissuade people from effectively confronting Hitler and Mussolini until it was too late. What are those same kinds of economic ties are able to prevent effective action in Iran? We'll see. Personally, I suspect that situation will develop into a cataclysmic scenario and one that will be much, much, much regretted. Not so much because a bunch of Jews will get killed, but it'll collapse the global economy. And that will be a source of real concern. Inside one, we were talking about a book called The War on Freedom, subtitled How and Why America Was Attacked. That book is by Nafiz Mossadegh Ahmed. It's become fairly well known in the September 11th Truth Movement. And we're talking about this book as an element of disinformation. Now, the main part of this book isn't too bad. As I said inside one, September 11th is a very complicated event. And certainly I would not expect most observers to be able to wrap themselves around it past a point. It is very complicated. And so the fact that the main body of the book, War on Freedom, is in and of itself inadequate, which it is not in and of itself a condemnation. Most of the books about September 11th are inadequate to one extent or another. Some are better than others. But what struck me about the book, it's precisely because the main body of the book, War on Freedom, isn't too bad, that the afterword or the backword by somebody named John Leonard struck me, because somebody that reads the first part of this book, the main body of the book, will certainly become aware that there were some very serious conspiratorial aspects to the September 11th events. And what they will get in the backword is basically pure, unadulterated fascist and Nazi worldview. One of the reasons why fascist elements around the world have been adhering to conspiracy theories of one kind or another is once somebody realizes that in point of fact Lee Harvey Oswald was not the lone nut assassin of President Kennedy, then they begin wondering, well, gosh, maybe the Holocaust didn't happen. It leaves them in an intellectually relativistic world, and then fascist elements can climb right in. Once you realize Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, and once you realize that, in fact, there was a lot more to September 11th than the official version, then it leaves a lot of people in a relativistic intellectual and moral universe, and then in comes stuff like this. One of the most heinous examples of revisionist, basically fascist revisionism, is in the backward or the afterword to the book War on Freedom, this by one John Leonard. And in this section of the book, basically, John Leonard is engaging in revisionism about as profound as one could. What he's presenting here is the part of the political agenda of a white supremacist group called the Posse Comitatus. One of the main elements of the Posse Comitatus is political ideology, and they're an affiliate of the white supremacist / Aryan Nations movement. They're associated with the Identity Christianity movement. Posse Comitatus specifically maintains that all power lies with the states and that the federal government has no power to impose taxation and other things. And what we are seeing in this book, The War on Freedom, is basically a conspiratorial view of September 11th, not in and of itself all that bad, but being used to crack open the door so that pure, unadulterated fascist and Nazi revisionism can be launched from that platform. John Leonard writes in the afterword, or the backword, to War on Freedom, "The war powers have been usurped and abused by the White House at least since the 1840s. A new book sharply assails the totalitarian basis of our modern union as laid by Abraham Lincoln over the rubble of the U.S. Constitution. Quote, Lincoln lusted after empire. The juggernaut he put in place exterminated the Plains Indians with the same ferocity with which southern towns and cities were sacked and pillaged by the Union armies. The Indians are in Palestine now, evicted into camps, demonized, and massacred in illegal wars. The Constitution grants all powers not delegated elsewhere to the states, and delegation of powers is not their abandonment or abuse. Thus, the war powers rightfully revert back to the individual states and need to be devolved to them to make such mutual defense agreements as they deem fit." Check this out again. Now, this book is being handed out as a premium on non-commercial radio stations. A lot of the Pacifica stations have handed this book out as a premium in some of their September 11th fundraising activity or September 11th related fundraising activity. Check out what this book says. Again, the main part of the book is not too bad, but it, to the extent that that gains the credibility of the reader so that basically they can throw them this curve. Thus, the war powers rightfully revert back to the individual states and need to be devolved to them to make such mutual defense agreements as they deem fit. The war powers belong to the individual states. No, Virginia, and no pun intended, they do not belong to the individual states. Congress is quite explicit about who has the war-making powers. Not, by the way, Dick Cheney, but Congress. And sure as bloody hell it ain't the states. But basically, this is pure fascist revisionism. This is the political ideology and agenda of the Posse Comitatus, except being presented as part of September 11th, quote, truth, unquote. Continuing. Speaking of this, this works perfectly in the European Union, for example, where people live more safely than we do, even in small countries, even without ocean barriers, with collective security arrangements, because they don't threaten their neighbors with trillion-dollar, quote, handguns, unquote. Because they practice pluralism, not absolutism, in relations between the nations. The last thing anyone needs is a military superpower, a loose cannon on the deck of the world that can be hijacked by an irresponsible clique. On the contrary, the world will be a safer and healthier place if Europe will reclaim its strategic and military independence in foreign policy. Europeans remember what living under aerial bombing means, and they do not yet have America's sheer one-track mind about the profit motive. What the world needs is to see more of Europe's wisdom and sense of balance. How did Switzerland, a cold and rocky spot with few resources, become the world's richest country? By its habits of neutrality and local autonomy, where the cantons collect a lion's share of revenue. Is it coincidence that the arguably unconstitutional Internal Revenue Act of 1913 passed just in time to give the feds the wherewithal to wage an insane great war in Europe, yet our states still have the right to secede? Very interesting bit of propagandizing here. And then, by the way, this book is from one DiLorenzo. The book is Professor Thomas DiLorenzo, and the book is promoted on a Washington Times website in the footnote to this book. The Washington Times, of course, owned by the Moon Organization. DiLorenzo writes that Lincoln and his generals should, quote, have been hanged as war criminals under the Geneva Convention of 1863. In our time, complicity, whether indirect or direct, in the Pearl Harbor and World Trade Center attacks is also a treasonable crime against humanity which should be prosecuted. So the war-making powers belong to the states. Abraham Lincoln was a war criminal. Interesting viewpoint here. And the Internal Revenue Act of 1913 is illegal. By the way, that one's gaining a lot of traction in the so-called progressive sector. And also, Posse Comitatus-related groups are making a lot of progress in the so-called progressive sector. People, at least in part, don't know who they are or what the arguments represent. But that is one of the most, one of the ripest things that I've seen sort of traveling in under the blanket of the 911, quote, truth movement. The war-making powers belong to the states, and Abraham Lincoln is a war criminal. Another guy who's emerged in the September 11th truth movement, again, a pure historical revisionist, is a guy named Andreas von Bülow, a former German legislator who has been in the past associated with the BND, an alleged oversight person. But if the same situation holds in Germany, basically somebody involved with the oversight and probably the managing of the BND. Von Bülow told AFP, that's the American Free Press, by the way, that is the successor organization to the Liberty Lobby's newspaper, The Spotlight. Von Bülow told American Free Press, a neo-Nazi paper basically, that he believes that the Israeli intelligence service Mossad is behind the September 11th attacks. These attacks, he said, were carried out to turn public opinion against the Arabs and boost military and security spending. Skipping down. The planners used corrupt guns for hire such as Abu Nidal, the Palestinian terrorist who von Bülow called an instrument of Mossad. Now listen to the following. The BND, that's the successor organization of the Gehlen organization, the BND, German Secret Service, is steered by the CIA, and the CIA is steered by Mossad. Unquote. Well, if anything, it's the other way around. But basically, this fellow von Bülow has gained, again, a lot of traction in the so-called September 11th truth movement. He was the guy who wrote the introduction to Rupert's book. And according to von Bülow, the BND is controlled by the CIA, and the CIA is controlled by the Mossad. Well, but of course, hasn't that always been the case? One of the most interesting examples of historical revisionism in connection with September 11th has been the successful marketing of FDR and the U.S. deliberately allowed Pearl Harbor to take place. There is a disinformation book called, appropriately enough, Day of Deceit. It actually should be called Volume of Deceit, that has been marketed and has also been bruited about by some of the fascist elements within the September 11th, quote, truth movement, unquote. The notion, again, the revised version of World War II, blaming World War II on FDR and blaming Pearl Harbor on FDR, is one of the elements of historical revisionism that has been relatively successful. Again, from the backward to the book The War on Freedom. Let's move along to Pearl Harbor on Hawaii, annexed like California in a subversive putsch, turning the Pacific into an American lake. Declassified files recently revealed that FDR was even more cunning than the conspiracy theorists believed. He not only let the Japanese attack Pearl Harbor, he first executed an 8-point plan to provoke and lure them, ensuring that they saw no alternative other than to attack. This, by the way, is the equivalent of Holocaust denial. This is the exact opposite of the truth. The poor Japanese were lured into World War II by the warmonger Roosevelt. It's actually surreal, but it's had a fair amount of distribution, and in particular, in connection with September 11th, it has had a lot of traction indeed. The fact of the matter is that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was one of the few people standing in the way of militarism in the Pacific, as was the case in the Atlantic. The Pacific theater in World War II was dominated by a relationship between powerful American industrialists and financiers, very small in number but vast in power, and their Japanese counterparts. Again, small in number but vast in power, and a worldwide cartel system which helped to elevate the Nazis to power and then armed them in the Second World War, functioned in a similar fashion in Japan. The Zaibatsu, the Japanese family trusts, and the emperor himself and his family dominated the Japanese economy, but their investment partners and their corporate partners were powerful American financiers and corporations, as discussed in, among other programs, For the Record 426. And the fact of the matter is that the Japanese War of Aggression, which really was going on more or less, going on and off since 1931, mostly on, was viewed with favor by powerful elements in the United States for two reasons. For one thing, the Japanese were seen as bulwarks against communism in the Pacific, much as the Germans were in the Atlantic. They were seen as a bulwark on the Pacific side of what I call the Earth Island, just as the Germans were seen, the German Nazis were seen as a bulwark on the European side of the Earth Island. But beyond that, since American industrialists and financiers were business partners with the dominant economic elements in Japan, they stood to benefit from the Japanese wars of aggression because the Japanese corporate interests and banks stood to profit from those wars of aggression. FDR, on the other hand, was trying to resist those wars. But keep an eye on the September 11th revisionism as it applies to the so-called September 11th truth movement. In both For the Record 298 and in For the Record 581, I talk about the growing inclination to blame World War II on Franklin Delano Roosevelt. We'll talk about that. I will go into that at greater length in the description to this program. To make a long story short, FDR was trying to cut off the shipments of steel and oil to the Japanese so they wouldn't perpetrate the sorts of atrocities that they did at Nanking. The rape of Nanking in 1937, the Japanese executed upwards of 300,000 Chinese, raped upwards of 80,000 Chinese women. Roosevelt was trying to stand against that kind of thing. Some very powerful elements on the other side of the aisle successfully resisted Roosevelt's attempts at cutting off American aid for that atrocity, the ongoing atrocities in the Pacific. He was not successful until late 1940 and early 41. Actually, in some cases, late 1941. The fact of the matter is, though, that the entire Pacific theater was on a war footing on December 7th, 1941. Had Admiral Kimmel and General Strong, particularly Admiral Kimmel, done his job, then the attack would have been resisted. I'll go into Pearl Harbor and some of the dynamics of the actual battle itself in the written description to this program. But among the things that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was trying to do, he was not only not the instigator of World War II, he was the hero of an awful lot of it, and in fact he was standing virtually alone against the trans-Pacific industrial and financial axis that was driving the Japanese war effort forward. And it was Franklin Delano Roosevelt who was attempting to cut off American support for atrocities like the rape of Nanking. And speaking of the rape of Nanking, that, too, is the focal point of historical revisionism. Following article appeared in the International Herald Tribune of Wednesday, January 24th of 2007. The article's Dateline Tokyo headline, Japanese director announces production of Nanjing film to deny massacre. It reads, when Japanese troops conquered the then capital of China in 1937, historians agree they slaughtered tens of thousands of civilians in an orgy of violence known since then as the Rape of Nanking. A Japanese nationalist filmmaker announced on Wednesday he is working on a documentary with a very different message, The Massacre Never Happened. The film, to be called The Truth About Nanking and completed in August, will be based on testimony from Japanese veterans, archival footage, and documents that proponents say prove accounts of the killing are nothing more than Chinese propaganda. So we're seeing Holocaust denial in the Pacific as well. With regard to the rape of Nanking specifically, Japanese denial of that crime, or the denial of that crime by right-wing Japanese elements, serves not only to, potentially at least, pave the way for a resurgence of far-right political propaganda in Japan, but it also serves to cover up, again, some of the very powerful political and economic interests at work. The Rape of Nanking was not produced by a bunch of Japanese going crazy. The Rape of Nanking was directed by Prince Asaka, the brother of Emperor Hirohito, and furthermore, it was the Rape of Nanking that saw the genesis of the Golden Lily looting program, which systematically looted Asia of all of its liquid wealth and then channeled that liquid wealth back into the political and economic axis that governed Japanese life in the post-World War II period. We have talked at great length about Golden Lily and about the programs that came out of that. In the description to the broadcast, I will go into that. I will annotate those references. However, for the purposes of the present discussion, note that a major right-wing Japanese director is producing a film that's going to deny that the Rape of Nanking happened. Not only was the Rape of Nanking directed by the emperor's brother, it saw the genesis of Golden Lily. Up of the Rape of Nanking, we read the following. We're going to turn now to the book Gold Warriors, subtitled America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, published in hardcover and softcover by Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. Just before the Japanese began their assault on Nanking, Emperor Hirohito sent his uncle, Prince Asaka Yasuhiko, to take over command from General Matsui Iwane, who was suffering from tuberculosis. In any aristocracy, there are always extreme nationalists and racists with a narrow education, and Japan was no exception. Men like Prince Asaka regarded themselves as demigods and felt only contempt for Chinese, Koreans, and other Asians. In addition, he was an alcoholic given to wild bouts of drunken rage. On taking command outside Nanking, he told his aides that it was time to, quote, teach our Chinese brothers a lesson they will never forget. In the Rape of Nanking that followed, some 300,000 defenseless civilians were slain by Japanese troops. Between 20 and 80,000 women of all ages were raped repeatedly, including children, adolescent girls, and grandmothers, many of them disemboweled in the process. Men, women, and children were subjected to acts of such barbarism that the world recoiled in horror. Thousands of men were roped together and machine-gunned or doused with gasoline and set afire. Others were used for bayonet practice or to practice beheading in a sporting competition to see which officer could behead the greatest number of victims that day. Weeks passed while atrocities continued, streets and alleys piled high with corpses. Unlike previous mass atrocities done out of sight, these were witnessed by hundreds of Westerners, including diplomats, doctors, and missionaries, some of whom smuggled out photographic evidence. It was at this bitter moment that Golden Lily came into existence. When the Japanese army swarmed down the China coast in 1937, crossed the Yangtze, and moved westward to Nanking, so many units were involved across such a broad front that there was danger of Japan's ruling elite losing control of the financial side of conquest as rival commanders competed for spoils. How could you keep army or navy officers from sidetracking gold bullion and priceless artworks, not to mention smaller scale theft by soldiers? At the same time, groups of Yakuza were moving through newly occupied areas conducting their own reign of terror. To keep everything under strict control at the highest level, the Imperial General Headquarters created Golden Lily, or Kin no Yuri, named after one of Hirohito's poems. This was to be a palace organization of Japan's top financial minds and specialists in all forms of treasure, including cultural and religious antiquities, supported by accountants, bookkeepers, shipping experts, and units of the Army and Navy, all overseen by princes of the blood. When China was milked by Golden Lily, the army would hold the cow while princes skimmed the cream. This organization was put directly under the command of the emperor's brother, Prince Chichibu. We know the date because the Imperial General Headquarters itself was only set up in the Imperial Palace in Tokyo in November of 1937, just as the Rape of Nanking was commencing. The purpose of the Imperial Headquarters was to keep control of the war in the hands of the emperor and his senior advisors, to avoid repeating what had happened in Manchuria, where the Kwantung army grew recklessly independent in all respects. The Imperial Army already had a number of special service units, among them intelligence teams specializing in different kinds of cultural and financial espionage, and secret service agents like General Doihara outside the ordinary command structure. These were reassigned to Golden Lily, giving it the resources needed to find all treasure of all kinds, from the sublime to the most prosaic. And that basically, the Rape of Nanking, saw the genesis of Golden Lily, and it was Golden Lily that put the liquid wealth of Asia, basically stolen at sword and gunpoint, into the hands of the powerful Japanese economic and political interests that in turn were cartel partners with their opposite numbers in the United States. And at the end of World War II, that cartel system was put back into place, and the crimes that generated the wealth of Golden Lily were effectively covered up. And now, if, in fact, some people get their way, the Rape of Nanking will be denied, much as the Iranians are now trying to deny the Holocaust, in combination with European and American neo-Nazis and white supremacists, just as some are now denying that World War II was started in the Pacific, anyway, by the Japanese. They're claiming it was FDR who was really trying to the one of the very few people standing against what was taking place. But slowly and surely, we're seeing a complete revision of history, and we're seeing the people who were the heroes of events being demonized as the villains. Yeah, Abraham Lincoln was a war criminal. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a war criminal. The South, of course, were just passive victims of Abraham Lincoln's war criminality and aggression, and the poor Japanese were just passive victims of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's aggression. Ye gods, folks! Things are reaching a very, very disturbing impasse indeed. But when combating the big lie, the best way to do that is with the big truth. I wouldn't dismiss the possibility that a lot of this stuff could eventually become accepted. There's a passage from Mein Kampf in which Hitler said, quote, "Most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big ones. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. All even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, as any trifling detail would dispose them to accept a thing as true. All good liars know this, therefore, and stop at nothing to achieve this end." Well, there are a lot of good liars at work. Whether they're able to succeed, that remains to be seen. Please do use the Spitfire website and the linked websites. There's a vast amount of information available, and indeed it'll flesh out your understanding. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 584, Rewriting History. This is being recorded on February 4th of 2007. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.